Church attorney from 1879 to 1932. So in the course of putting together the materials for that, Ken, of course, had the opportunity to immerse himself in a lot of the stuff we'll be talking about today. My name is Rex Sears. I am not a recovering attorney, and I know some people who've had the wisdom to do law school, start practicing law, realize it was a mistake, and then go to graduate school. I did things the other way around, so I think I'm stuck here for the long haul. I'm an attorney practicing here in Salt Lake, and my practice has absolutely nothing to do with polygamy, but I've done some reading and writing in the area, including a piece that's going to be that the Utah Law Review folks tell me is at the publishers now on the congressional debates over polygamy issues, the constitutional dimensions of those. So, and then, of course, our guest of honor is Ms. Sarah Gordon, author of The Mormon Question. I have to express my admiration for Ms. Gordon. My wife stood by me through a PhD in philosophy and then law school, but she drew the line when I then mentioned divinity school and history as the next prospect. Ms. Gordon has been much more successful than I in that regard. She has managed to work in a PhD in American history at Princeton, a JD at Yale, a master's in social ethics at Yale, and most importantly, an undergraduate degree in German literature at Vassar. No, you made that request, but I think it's important for these people here to know that. So. Most recently, Ms. Gordon has authored a wonderful book that we're here today to discuss. I will start with a few comments of my own, and then we'll proceed in the order the names are listed in the program. I'll be followed by Paul and Ken, and then I will turn the time over to Ms. Gordon. I was glad I had the opportunity to read this book, The Mormon Question, in case some of you haven't seen it. I find it an important and remarkable book. I came to this book having read Van Wagner's and Hardy's books on the history of polygamy, Orma Winfrey's treatment on the accompanying jurisprudence, Hansen's and Lyman's history of Mormon political ambitions and aspirations, and also having done some independent research and writing on the constitutional issues raised by anti-polygamy legislation. But I've never before been exposed to such a comprehensive view as we find in this book. That is, such a comprehensive view of the Mormon question. The two most important things that I take from this book are context and a better understanding and appreciation for at least one key piece of that context, namely the anti-polygamist's moral constitutionalism. Before turning to other matters, let me briefly elaborate on each. With regard to context in general, Ms. Gordon makes a very valuable contribution by elaborating the Gentile side of the question. It seems to me that the Mormon ideological and social context for polygamy has been well explored, but because Mormons are now about the only people who are interested in this bit of history, the Gentile context has been neglected. Ms. Gordon brings to life some parts of the Gentile background that need to be integrated to develop a better understanding of the history of the Mormon question. Some of the pieces Ms. Gordon weaves into the fabric bear an obvious relation to her topic. The existence of a body of anti-polygamy fiction is not news, but I, for one, had very little familiarity either with its contents or its significance until I read Ms. Gordon's book. Ms. Gordon also integrates other Gentile matters whose relevance to the Mormon question was not so obvious. Perhaps the most striking example from an amateur legal historian's point of view is the palpable relationship in people's perceptions and legal thinking between broader antitrust issues and legislation on the one hand and legislation directed specifically against the corporate church. And again, I point to that as just a striking example of this broader context that I think has been missed before. With regard to the moral constitutionalism that justified and developed out of anti-polygamist legislation and legal action, I now have a better grasp of the ideological framework that I had previously glimpsed in legal opinions and congressional debates, but I'd never really understood. I wouldn't want to lay claim to a complete understanding of it right now, but I certainly have a lot more, I know a lot more about it than I did before, having had the opportunity to read this. I want Ms. Gordon to know that I have learned much from reading her book, but my praise and compliments do not give her much to respond to. So let me now turn to some questions. I have five, three that are fairly narrow and two that are broader. And feel free to pick and choose which to respond to. Some of them might be helpful enough not to give much interest to a general audience. The first two questions arise out of your treatment of the Reynolds decision. As you know, Reynolds persists as a cornerstone of constitutional jurisprudence on religion. But as presented in your book, the case should have been about federal legislation on issues previously reserved for local treatment, and the Supreme Court disregarded both that issue and relevant precedent when it made its decision on free exercise grounds. Now, in the first place, it is my understanding that at least as far back as 1828, the Supreme Court had recognized that in legislating for the territories, and this is a quote from the American Insurance v. Canner case, Congress exercises the combined powers of the general and of the state government. During the 1854 and 1860 congressional debates over the Homestead Act and the Morrill Act, Southern congressmen, increasingly concerned about the impact of federal exclusion from certain territories, insisted that the authority of the federal government was much narrower in scope, and the Southerners' cause was strengthened by the Dred Scott decision. But it had been my understanding that the Civil War effectively ended that debate and validated the earlier view. So I was surprised by the tenor of your treatment, which suggested that the theory of limited federal authority to legislate for the territories was still viable by 1878. I would have thought that argument dead on arrival. I'm wondering if anybody successfully relied on a limited view of federal authority to challenge federal territorial legislation after the Dred Scott decision was overruled by the Civil War. And more generally, if you think the Mormon lawyers had any plausible basis for thinking that their argument retained any persuasive value after the Civil War. My second question, although prompted by your treatment of Reynolds, is not directly concerned with it. Your treatment of Reynolds gives short shrift to the free exercise issues, the issue of whether the Mormon practice of polygamy was rendered immune from federal legislation by the First Amendment provision, which prohibits Congress from passing any law restricting the free exercise of religion. That's a fine sentence as written, but it probably doesn't come across well spoken, so let me break it out just a little bit. The First Amendment, of course, has with respect to religion, two important clauses, one against an establishment of religion, and two, guaranteeing free exercise. And so that's the free exercise issue, and your treatment of Reynolds gives short shrift to that. Whether or not that was an issue to which the Mormon attorneys devoted much argument, and whether or not it was properly before the court, that issue had certainly been in play in other public arenas. Orson Pratt's 1852 sermon that first formally acknowledged the practice of polygamy centered on a defense of the Mormons' right to engage in a practice that was based explicitly on the Free Exercise Clause. Congressional debates over both the Homestead and Morrill Act addressed not only the scope of federal power to legislate for the territories, but also the free exercise issue. It seems to me that by 1878, the federal authority, as I mentioned before, it seemed to me before coming to this book that by 1878 the federal authority issue was dead and deserved no more attention than it got, leaving the free exercise issue as the only important issue left standing. I have not read the briefing for the Reynolds case, and you have, so you're in a much better position than I to speak on what was actually before the court. But whether or not the free exercise was properly before the court, it seems to me that there should have been more to say about how the issue figured in the thinking of both Mormons and anti-polygamists. Third, I am curious about why the decision in Davis v. Beeson only gets treated as part of the aftermath. That decision affirmed an Idaho territorial provision effectively prohibiting a citizen from voting if he were affiliated with an organization that advocated polygamy, and Congress was expected to follow up with comparable legislation for Utah Territory. It seems to me that the specter of wholesale disenfranchisement raised by Davis was also important in securing the final capitulation of the Mormon Church. So I'm wondering why it gets relegated to the epilogue instead of being treated alongside the dissolution of the corporate church. Turning to more general matters, in the epilogue you say that the constitutional strategies developed and employed by evangelical Christians in the anti-polygamist crusade have now been turned against them. Now, under the moral constitutionalism of the evangelical anti-polygamist crusade, the Constitution recognized and imposed a positive governmental duty to promote Republican ideals by protecting religious and domestic arrangements that foster Protestant liberty. Religious disestablishment in particular was about rendering pastors accountable to their congregations rather than governmental non-interference. As I understand it, you are claiming that the anti-polygamist evangelicals pioneered the strategy of enforcing a particular substantive moral vision through constitutional jurisprudence, and now their opponents are using the same approach to enforce a different moral vision. But to me, it seems that the constitutional reverses that evangelicals have experienced on issues like school prayer reflect a shift away from substantive constitutional jurisprudence altogether to a more formalistic jurisprudence in which restrictions on government action are understood to require the government to be content neutral. The problem for the evangelicals currently is not that one substantive interpretation of the Constitution has been abandoned in favor of another, but that substantive interpretations have been abandoned altogether. This establishment, in particular, now means that government may not concern itself directly with the content of any religious creed or the corresponding structure of any religious organization. Government cannot favor one creed as fostering Republican ideals and another as not, because those very ideals are now understood to bar the government from making that kind of evaluative inquiry. Reynolds' distinction between action and belief survives, but much of the rest of the scaffolding of the Reynolds opinion and later decisions does not. In particular, the rhetoric in Reynolds and the other opinions about safeguarding democracy against the presumed despotism of polygamy, I do not think could find its way into modern decisions. That is not because a pro-polygamous ethic now prevails, or because people no longer believe that polygamic patriarchy impairs the cultivation of Republican ideals in its participants, but rather because government is no longer in the business of evaluating the content of religions or any particular domestic arrangements, because those religions, arrangements those religions may prescribe to determine whether they foster or fit with our political ideals. Anti-polygamy legislation might still be viable as an exercise of the police power, but only because and insofar as it goes to action and not belief. The substantive justification promoting Republican ideals would no longer be accepted, because those ideals are now understood to require neutrality. And so I'm unclear as to what you mean when you say that the strategies of the anti-polygamists have been turned against them. Final comment on that. Your epilogue is titled The Unfaithful Constitution. I gathered that it received that title because it seems that the Constitution had changed allegiances. I find the title, but not because I think the Constitution's loyalties have shifted away from the evangelicals' moral vision to someone else's. Rather, I think the Constitution now admits of no such allegiance. Am I wrong about that? My last question arises out of a lingering puzzlement that has been diminished but not wholly removed by your book. An early justification for the anti-polygamist crusade was the presumed suffering of women in the polygamic system. Once it became clear that Mormon women were willing participants, the crusade continued and found a new rationale. The goal of abolishing Mormon difference remained throughout, finding new justifications as necessary. What ultimately do you think drove the anti-polygamy crusade?
I'm pleased to have been invited to respond and participate in this discussion. I hope that many of you were at last night's presentation where Professor Gordon essentially gave us a summary in about an hour of this whole book, and did it in a very articulate and illuminating way that I think captured the attention of even people who were not familiar with the issues of the Mormon question. I think this is an extremely important book, both for Mormons and non-Mormons. It fills an important gap in certain ways, but it adds a new dimension to things for us, I believe. Whatever the virtues of the new Mormon history, as we sometimes call it, and we go back and say we arbitrarily start with the Great Basin Kingdom, and there are many virtues, but one of the virtues has not been the incorporation or synthesizing of the broader American history with the Mormon history. We've tended to be a little bit insular, even in our studies. This is a book which does just an incredible job, I think, of bringing these strands together, the big issues in American history of constitutional law, of federalism versus states' rights, of free exercise of religion, the slavery question, the sectionalism, all these big things are part of this story, and yet they are intimately tied to the Mormon story. And sometimes we forget that. I really must congratulate Professor Gordon in doing that for us. And I particularly commend to you and the other students of Mormon history this kind of perspective and this treatment. I'm impressed as one who has really grown up in this culture and been involved in one way or another with these issues for pretty much all my life. I'm terribly impressed that someone who does not come from that background but can come into it and get a grasp of it and synthesize it for us in this way, terribly, terribly impressive. And it's, I think we have found in Mormon history that it's rather remarkable to have an outsider who comes in without a particular agenda other than to illuminate and can show us some of the special relevance of our own history. So the book is particularly strong in terms of it being a very readable, a very articulate discussion. It is very accessible. Those of you who were at last night's discussion, and if you haven't looked at the book yet, most of the cartoons that Professor Gordon showed us on the screen last night are also in the book, and they really bring a reality, particularly to the 19th century emotional conflicts that were going on about this whole question. In other words, it's not just about a bunch of dry legal cases and appellate briefs and all that stuff. The most important part of the book, I think, and maybe that's too strong, but at least for me, the most interesting and important is the very epilogue that Rex mentioned. Interestingly entitled, The Unfaithful Constitution. And there's, I think Rex has raised the very salient question about that. But the epilogue is a profound essay, in my view, of the implications of this whole historical study. It's a profound essay, and it holds within it what I think are the seeds for much further study and speculation and research and wondering about where these issues will go in the future. And that's what I would like to devote the rest of my time to just very briefly. I found it, Rex commented on the Davis versus Beeson case, and I wasn't so concerned about where it appeared in the text, but it is an extremely important case, and it's not the one that's usually talked about. We always talk about Reynolds. We seldom talk about Davis versus Beeson, but that was the case where the Supreme Court said, not only can you not practice polygamy, you cannot even belong to an institution that advocates something like this. Even if you don't do it, if you belong, you can't vote. That was that's really the extreme end of the limitations on free exercise of religion in our constitutional jurisprudence. The most recent case that came along in the wake of Reynolds and directly challenging Reynolds with respect to polygamy as such was another Utah case in the 1980s about a Murray policeman named Royston Potter who got fired for practicing polygamy. Now, if you're going to bring a polygamy case and you want to test Reynolds and go into all those free exercise issues and try to get Reynolds overturned, probably the last profession you want to be in is a policeman. It did not help his case to be a policeman. Another profession could have probably gotten further. I'm not suggesting that that Reynolds was in any great danger of being overturned at that time, but some people were hopeful because in the 1970s, Justice Douglas, in... Where are we getting our feedback here? John, where are you?
Come outside to talk. I can talk loud enough.
Actually, if I don't use the microphone, the tape won't pick it up, so I guess I better. That sounds better. Anyway, Royston Potter was fired for being a policeman and tried to challenge the Reynolds case, and they were going primarily on a statement that Justice Douglas had made in the Yoder case, and Professor Gordon mentions this this case, where he puzzled about whether they weren't already implicitly overturning Reynolds, and speculated that someday they might explicitly do so. And some people really thought, I think, that was going to happen. Well, in spite of Royston Potter having the disadvantage of being a policeman, his lawyer did see what I think was the best strategy available at that time, and given where the free exercise cases had evolved to that point, he took the position that in order to continue to see the Reynolds decision as valid constitutional law, the state of Utah would be under the burden of showing in a very dramatic way their compelling state interest in having monogamy be the only recognized form of marriage. In other words, what they wanted the state to do in the Potter case was to put on empirical evidence showing that the legislature had made a conscious determination that monogamy was the superior form of social organization, and that polygamy was an inferior or even detrimental form, and only if you could meet that burden could you outlaw polygamy. Well, of course, I was representing the state and had the job of defending the existence of laws that prohibited polygamy. Interestingly enough, one of the things that we did, not really out loud to the court, but we said, you know, we're not sure that the legislature ever made such a conscious determination. That's probably going to be kind of hard to prove. Well, one of the ironies was that we tried to get the federal government to come in and give their justification for these laws, saying, look, it was the federal government that insisted that Utah have in its constitution, before it could be admitted, a perpetual prohibition of polygamy. Well, the Justice Department did not like that idea, that they should have to come in. And they got out of it as fast as they could. The case was before an elderly, then senior status federal judge here in Utah named A. Sherman Christensen, who had been around for many years, and he knew all this history, and he was an active Latter-day Saint. And I have nowhere near the time to go into the details here, but to make a long story short, what we had to do in that case was avoid the burden of trying to demonstrate that empirically that monogamy was the superior form of the social organization, polygamy had to be prohibited, and we did that essentially by just rehashing without quite the same rhetoric the arguments in Reynolds. Judge Christensen, throughout Royston Potter's case, it went to the Tenth Circuit in Denver, where we went through the same sort of arguments again, and the Tenth Circuit decision is really the meaningful one in that case. It's the one that's the binding one. But even after Royston Potter lost at the Tenth Circuit in Denver, and they reaffirmed Reynolds, Weston Potter took it on certiorari to the United States Supreme Court. That means that it is like an appeal, but the Supreme Court does not have to hear it. The vast majority of cases that go up on certiorari are not even heard. They're summarily dismissed without a hearing. That's what we wanted in this case. And another one of the ironies of this whole story was that our main consultant on taking that case, briefing it on the writ of certiorari in the Supreme Court, was Rex Lee, then BYU president and the descendant of some of the most well-known polygamists in Utah history. And he gave us the very sound advice, and which proved to be accurate. These guys on the Supreme Court don't want to wrestle with Reynolds again right now. Give them a reason in a very short statement why they don't need to, and they'll throw this out. And that's what they did. Well, there's going to eventually there will be more cases like this, and the epilogue in this book gives much food for thought about what may come down the pike. There's reference here to the issue of gay marriages and this issue of whether the people who advocated a freedom of religion and a freedom to practice alternate kinds of marriage in the 19th century are now in the 21st century completely on the other side. That will play itself out probably over a long period of time. I would certainly suggest that there's lots of room for further exploration of that issue. Another aspect that I would like to raise here, again, as far as ongoing study and research and what's going to happen in the future, and this was barely even visible on the horizon as Professor Gordon was doing her research and writing, but now it's become very, very clear to us that the religious issues with respect to Islam are going to play out in our legal system. Islam has a basic principle of polygamy. What is the status of practicing Islamic people in the United States? But even more so, and why I don't foresee in my lifetime Reynolds ever being overturned, I think this whole thing with Islamic fundamentalism, with terrorists, with issues that are going to come up, is going to cause the courts to become even more tight. Rather than loosening this belief-action distinction that Reynolds is the precedent for, rather than going the way Justice Douglas thought they might, I think for several decades it's going to go the other direction. I think it's going to become tighter. You're going to see criminal prosecutions now of people who will justify their actions based on some religious belief, and the courts will wind up saying, nope, you can't. Whatever your belief is, that's fine, but you can't do that, or you can't do this, or whatever particular thing. One of the great strengths, I think, of this book, and especially the value that I can't say enough about, of Professor Gordon's multidisciplinary approach, is seeing the complexities, the interweaving of all this. And some of us, I think, grew up with sort of a pristine notion of constitutional law as being very rational and very predictable, and it's all been written down already. The Supreme Court follows the election returns. That has been observed many times. They will continue to do so unless polygamy somehow becomes a popular the beneficiary of popular sentiment. It's not going to become the beneficiary of any radical Supreme Court decisions permitting it again. But I would really invite Professor Gordon to indulge all of us with a little further speculation along those lines based on her own research.
Sally and I met each other 20 years ago. I have an LLM, which is something you get after your JD that's virtually worthless, but you put it on your wall, in legal history from the University of Wisconsin, which is like the center of legal history. And the idea of legal history many times is that historians have no idea what is going on in law libraries and what sources may be there, and that maybe this is a way to help explain that. And my major professor at the University of Wisconsin was a JD slash PhD like Sally is, named Joseph Hartog, who then got bought by Princeton from Wisconsin, and is now at Princeton, and that's where her doctoral work is now. And I guess it's good to put us in connection along with some other future friends. Looking around at faces I recognize in here, many of y'all are probably familiar with this already, but what most laymen don't know is that before the time of the Mormon cases in the 1870s, beginning in 1879, and the 1880s and 1890s, the Supreme Court had never really wrestled with the religion clauses in the First Amendment. There are two clauses. There's what we lawyers call the free exercise clause, which means the state can't say you can't do this act that's part of your religion, or can't compel you to do something that your religion may prohibit. And then there's something called the establishment clause, which says that the state can't establish or foster one religious denomination or another, and that's what we're fighting about in the nativity scenes and school prayer and things like that. To me, the free exercise clause has always been much more important in terms of religious life than the establishment clause. And the Supreme Court, because in my mind the Mormons were the pariahs of the country, we were the Al-Qaeda of the 1880s, pretty much didn't get much out of the Supreme Court, and it set the court on a course that I see as essentially hostile to religious practice that continues to this day. We lost most of those cases. And beginning with polygamy, but it went well beyond the practice of polygamy. It reached the point of where, when we got to Davis versus Beeson, which we've heard mentioned a couple of times, basically the Supreme Court said Mormons have no rights as citizens. We can simply strip all of your rights away from you as a citizen. And the Supreme Court said, sure, there isn't any problem. And so, one of the other things that I was exposed to, I was a public defender before I went to my LLM program, and then for the last 11 years I've done principally death penalty work, defense work. I intuitively knew this but never heard of it until I went to this country. But there's something called critical legal studies or legal realism, which essentially says that what they teach you in law school, that the judges go back to the inner sanctum and reason through all these systems of logic and arrive at this logical resolution, there's a bunch of them. The courts are political. What goes on in the court system is the ins versus the outs. People in power attempt to keep power, economic power attempts to keep itself. Unpopular minorities are oppressed or harassed through the device of the courts. Mormons had that feeling when they came to Utah. And I personally strongly believe in critical realism. I think I'm very skeptical of the court's observations about how they logically reach these things. And I personally view the Mormon experience in the 19th century as the classic example of that kind of process at work in courts. My own view is that a lot of the hostility towards the Mormons came because they were immigrants. In many instances, the country was very nativistic and anti-immigrant. Mormon tolerance for the Indians ran against sort of the national move, and the Mormon sense of community really offended a lot of the rest of the country. Was considered sort of alien and foreign, and I was not there last night, but I suspect that some of the cartoons you may have shown were some that sort of lumped Mormons and Catholics together, the Pope and the Prophet were the same sort of alien, threatening monster. I love the cartoons that have the Mormon octopus with its tentacles going into all the states. You see that in a lot of stuff too. And so with that little bit of preface, I personally think this book is a really valuable book. I reviewed it very positively in the Journal of Mormon History. It's coming up yet. You're welcome. It is a demanding book. I think that you need to have some background in this area to read it, or it's going to be a little hard to wade through. A couple of the strengths. Well, let me mention a couple of other books and then talk about the strengths. There's a book called Zion in the Courts that's published by a couple of LDS law professors. It's 1988, University of Illinois Press. It's still in print, which I always thought was a very interesting, good book. I'm not sure if there's anything else really out there. But what Sally has done is essentially covered a lot of the same territory that's in Zion in the Courts, only from the anti-Mormon perspective, from the the other side, the issues that Mormons were having to respond to. There's another book that I believe is also published by the University of North Carolina Press called Governing the Heart, which has to do with the evolution of family law in the United States, and has a lot in there about the Mormon cases. If I remember that book, a lot of it has to do with how marriage and family relations was considered a private individual matter that the state had no role in, and along come the Mormons, and everybody suddenly got scared witless by the Mormons, and all of a sudden they wanted the government to come in and regulate family law and family relationships because they saw the Mormons as so threatened, when that was not considered a matter for the state to be involved in before that. So, and I consider that another example of sort of critical legal studies of work. The two things in the book that particularly I found interesting, and this may have to do with my interest, but she utilizes some research that I'd not seen before about the prosecution of women. That I had always thought that women were sort of incidental victims of these prosecutions when they refused to testify and things like that. She compiled some data about the prosecution of women late in the campaign that I hadn't seen before, and I found very interesting. I think it's only like a couple of paragraphs in one page, but I would love to see some more on that and maybe some of the pleadings in that. I gather that she went through all of the United States District Court records and got her information on this firsthand, which I've never done, and I commend her for that, but I'd like to see more about that. The other thing that I found especially interesting is in 1890, just a matter of literally weeks before the manifesto, the Supreme Court decides a case called the Lake Corporation of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Well, under the Edmunds-Tucker Act, and actually it reaffirmed some earlier acts, Congress said, you're not an organization, basically you're a criminal, you're the mafia, and it was pre-RICO, you know, it was like before the RICO statute, we're going to go and take all of your assets. We're going to seize them and liquidate them, and they're all going to go into the public realm somehow. And I know from some research I did on Franklin Snyder Richards, the church attorney at the time, the law passed, he was scrambling around trying to deed every piece of property he could in the names of some local state president or some friendly guy, you know, so that it wasn't such seizure. And he was actually fairly successful at hiding a lot of these assets, or at least getting them out from under the reach of the law. But still, the feds were able to seize assets which are probably worth about $50 million today. And just a very short time before the manifesto issue, they had taken steps to begin seizing the temples because there had been some exemptions for strictly religious practices like that. At any rate, I always felt that the Lake Corporation case is the thing that brought the manifesto. And one day I want to do some more writing on that. But I have not seen anything anywhere, and I've done a lot of reading in this area, that discusses it like Sally does in this book. And if there's any other reason to read the book, for me as a legal historian, that section is a reason to read the book. Like both of the other commenters, I would have liked to see more about Davis versus Beeson. This has to do with my personal identification as a Mormon, I guess. But Davis versus Beeson is one of those cesspools of American law. It has all the moral authority of the Dred Scott decision in Plessy v. Ferguson. It is outrageous law in terms of its intolerance of other people. I find it particularly offensive because Anton Scalia on the Supreme Court loves Davis v. Beeson. He's citing it over and over again without the slightest appreciation of how expensive a case like that is. And it is still, absolutely, and it is still considered good law in this country. But I'd like to see more done on Davis versus Beeson. I suppose the one thing that, the one unanswered area of the book that's clearly outside of the scope of the book, that I don't know anybody can answer, is what was Mormon community life really like in this period of time? And was all of this hostility and criticism that came from the rest of the world based in reality? Or was it, were we just a designated whipping boy for the fears of the American middle class in that period of time? Or was there some real basis? She makes some observations in her book. I think there was something about, I remember about, the church was opposed to public school systems and had to help and was interested in fostering an ecclesiastical school system, sort of parochial school system, and this was seen as sort of an anti-Republican. I'd like to have seen that issue developed a little more. Frankly, I was just kind of ignorant of that area. And things like that, I am aware of from the books I in the courts of how the church court system worked, and in some instances bishop's courts, and in some instances sort of supplanted civil courts and became the forum for resolving a lot of conflicts that even non-Mormons came into because they saw it as a home game. those parts of the book interesting, but they were sort of teases because she would make references to some of these problem areas without necessarily developing them. But I think that may have been outside the scope of the book. As I read the book, what she was trying to explain to us is the rhetoric. This was what was being said. This was the campaign. I don't know that she was trying to say this is true or not. I think in many instances she seemed to feel that this was not true. I will acknowledge that some of the things I read in the book were pretty uncomfortable reading for me as a committed Mormon, sixth-generation Mormon. Those are my ancestors. They talked about it in there, and I found that really uncomfortable to read about people that I had respect for. But I mentioned this in my review, and I think this is true. She's not writing that because this is a position she took, but she was trying to help us understand the climate, the state of national politics, and where we were in the middle of that. You have to kind of keep an eye on that point, I think, as you read the book, and then it makes a whole lot more sense to you. I will say I've been involved with some litigation and legal issues that involve fundamentalist Mormons in Utah and the West today, and I found a lot of the rhetoric and discourse that's described from the 1880s in the book to be very, very similar, sometimes right down to the language, to the kind of stuff you hear about fundamentalist Mormons today. And I found that particularly interesting. But in summary, it's a great book. I think you should read it, but don't do it as you're sleepy in the bed. This is a book you got to pay attention to. I mean, it is a demanding book, and I think it's going to be a book that people are going to be reading for a long time. It's the only thing out there that covers this territory, and it's really a major work.
Sally, I just want to point out that you don't have to go back and get a PhD in sociology to answer that last major question. Nobody else can do that part.
My wife put me out of the business. I just wanted to quickly note that what we'll have now is we'll give Professor Gordon some time to respond. And by the way, my apologies if you've been referring to this professor earlier. I've been writing papers and referring to Mr. this and this chat. But my apologies. Professor Gordon will give her some time to respond to the comments that the panelists have made, and then we'll open up the questions.
I took notes on three scattered pages, and I will try to weave a little bit together over a couple of minutes and have it make some sense, I hope, if it doesn't just stop listening. First of all, I'd like to thank you for, all three of you, for your generosity and your perspicacity, but mostly, not only the three of you, but everybody I've met here for your welcome. As has been made clear, I am an outsider. Worse, I'm an Episcopalian from Philadelphia who has no connection to Mormonism, anti-Mormonism, polygamy, anti-polygamy. I came to this topic because it is the big constitutional question of the second half of the 19th century. It follows, cleans up, makes messier, tangles, untangles, and all the rest of it. Many of the major questions that we're looking at about the relationship of local to center, individual to state, husbands to wives, masters to servants, and so on. Questions that were left open by the Civil War, but that were burning questions. This was the single biggest place for those kinds of issues to be addressed. And as Ken noted, in many times they were addressed with a graphic and insulting tone that I certainly was shocked to find. In fact, I can tell you, the guy who wrote Governing the Heart, Michael Grossberg, called me up after he read my book and he said, you know, I was so shocked by the cartoons and the levels of violence in the cartoons. And it seems to me that this is a separate book. There are two books going on here. There's one that is about this rhetoric of moral constitutionalism, and then there's this violence in the cartoons. And I said, Mike, the rhetoric is every bit as violent as those pictures, and considerably more graphic. You know, there's not a lot of gore in the pictures, and there's plenty of gore, blood and gore, in the rhetoric. So much of it is shocking. And in many senses, people on both sides of the question, but primarily anti-polygamists, use violence and shock and overstatements to get things done. And what they wanted to get done was this very important conflict. Both sides wanted to emerge with the Constitution in their pocket. Both sides claimed to be good Americans. Both sides claimed allegiance to the very Constitution that they claimed the other side had betrayed. So it really was a battle that consumed the soul in some ways and was about the foundational document in American history, one that we still battle over. And here, let me just quickly take up just one of for example, and here I want to address the question with a little more specificity. Anti-polygamists were committed disestablishmentarian. In other words, they believe that one of the central issues that they had to battle in Utah was the relationship of church and state, and that by untangling those relationships, they would, A, provoke the downfall of the Mormon Church, which was always part of what they wanted, but B, encourage both individual liberty and responsible citizenship. They really believed that those things came from separating church and state. They also believed that they would produce more committed Christians as a result, Christians who would want to pray all the time and so on. As we all know, the language of disestablishment has been turned against many expressions of religious commitment in schools, in public places, and so on. So in some sense, one of the key motivations of anti-polygamists has been turned against their intellectual descendants. And that might be the beginnings of an answer to one of Rex's questions. And also, I think the Reynolds case is, yes, local power was still very important, and we can talk about some cases, some from Utah, some from others afterwards. Reynolds was also an establishment case. What was the role of the Mormon Church in Utah? This was an extremely, it was not only a free exercise case, but also an establishment clause case. And this is central to understanding the conflict. With Paul's comments, I must say, I agree. I think Reynolds is stronger now than it was 20 or even 30 years ago. I'm not sure I agree that Davis against Beeson is still good law. I think Scalia has cited it with some vigor, but that his fellow justices have distanced themselves from the case is also clear to me. And everyone here is right. It is pretty much a cesspool. It also is a lazy case, and eventually I consigned it to my epilogue because I just couldn't get quite interested enough in it. It spends so much of its time quoting Reynolds, and it's mostly a conglomeration of quotes from other places. I think it is an important case, but I do think Lake Corporation is the hammer, and this is a nasty whip that adds one more welt. But the real sledgehammer was the property of the church, and that case was indeed devastating. Ken's absolutely right, though. The church was very, very successful at hiding property, and the government never got anywhere close to what they hoped they would get, nor when they gave it back, did they give back as much as they had taken. They were not great managers of church wealth or church property. So I guess in conclusion, what I'd like to say, first of all, is thank you. Thank you for having me here. Thank you for your generosity. Thank you especially for your questions that provoke me to think more and deeply. And also thank you for reading a book that, although my husband tells me is excellent bedtime reading because Take a paragraph, any paragraph, and by the end of it, you'll be sound asleep. I have constantly struggled with the qualities of the difficulty of reading, especially among people who are so committed not only to their faith, but of the role of the past in their ongoing lives of faith. And I have tried as much as I can to respect that. And I understand that there are uncomfortable places, and I thank Ken and others for their generosity in realizing that my motivation was precisely that, to get to the bottom of what has been an understudied phenomenon, certainly from the anti-polygamous perspective, but also from the perspective of Mormons who were drawing on very, very powerful constitutional arguments throughout the conflict. And with that, I'll sit down and look forward to your questions.
I hadn't realized that you were an outsider. I was actually wondering when I was reading the book if you were a Gentile from Utah, if you were a Mormon. I had no idea, so which I think is another compliment. In terms of questions, if you have a short question, I'd be happy to repeat it into the microphone for you. If it's a longer question, please come up and ask from the microphone so that we can get it on the tape. In the back, and then... That question already sounds too long.
I'll try to abbreviate.
Not too long to ask.
Rather than always look to overturning Reynolds, is there a strategy that could be developed that goes after the privacy issues of the Constitution? And can homosexual marriages be the key that unlocks that whole privacy issue, and that it can become de-religionized and just become an issue of two consenting adults entering the marital contract? Is that a possibility?
Let me just point out that that Sally did she gives us a start down that road by talking about Griswold, which is the beginning of the privacy line of cases, and I would simply add that whole concept to my encouragement for further study, analysis, and yeah, there's a whole field out there, and I would also like to hear Sally's thoughts about where privacy law will take us, completely apart from free exercise and establishment.
All right. Well, I'm happy as ever to gab. I guess I would say that privacy cases probably provided a better venue 20 years ago than they do now. That's my own personal opinion. I think the abortion cases have shown us that privacy is perhaps not as rigorous or vigorous a constitutional tool as they may have appeared in the late 60s and early 70s. Indeed, I was talking to one of the women who litigated several of the major abortion cases and who had followed up on earlier hints that the key to Roe against Wade was going to be privacy, and she thinks equal protection would have been a better venue. I guess I see the turn certainly of the Supreme Court as a way away from a broad-based vision of privacy. I can always be proved wrong, but my sense is that what we'll most likely see is a vigorous development within various states and localities, and that once again what we may see, and I think this would be fascinating, is the test of local difference against the center, especially with a Supreme Court that has on the one hand been so solicitous, so vocal, catering to states' rights, and with the other being extremely imperial and saying there are certain questions that are simply national and that we own. And it would be interesting to see whether gay marriage produces such a conflict at the court, and it wouldn't surprise me to see see that it did.
Just to throw a couple more comments along these same lines out, it seems to me that in the current legal context, it's a rich, you can distinguish profitably more issues than you could in the original Reynolds decision, arising in part out of the fact that after the Reynolds decision came down, you had legislation directed at cohabitation as opposed to marriage. So as a matter of law, you can distinguish between the marriage on the one hand and the acts that go with it on the other, the marriage and cohabitation, the polygamy and the cohabitation. And so in terms of following up with privacy law, it seems you can divide out these three issues: the marriage, the private relations, what happens in the bedroom, and the public holding yourself out as having more than one wife. And some of the decisions have focused on the holding yourself out as an important issue that society has a right to regulate. And if you break it down, some of these are more subject to attack than others. The marriage, it seems to me that if you're just talking about a religious ceremony where someone says, God sees you as married to this woman now, it seems to me that you can make an argument, and this is half of Utah has a law right now, the current law that prohibits bigamy and cohabitation. It seems to me that you can attack the marriage side of it on religious protection grounds and say that mere religious ceremony shouldn't be subject to state regulation. In terms of the incidents that go along with it, if you're just talking about what people who don't make their polygamy public, then I think the gay conduct is a very good analog. In Bowers v. Hardwick, for those of you who don't know, before 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 15 years ago, affirmed the government's right to regulate what happens in the bedroom, in particular, upheld anti-sodomy legislation. And one thing that some people interested in this issue have pointed to is a possible equal enforcement issue. And that arises if you live in a jurisdiction that does not enforce adultery laws against publicly unfaithful people, people who flaunt their mistresses, things like that. You could go after that aspect of the polygamous relationship if you live in a jurisdiction where these kinds of laws are not enforced against people who make their extramarital affairs public. So those are some ways of dividing up the issue that may ultimately prove fruitful.
Two questions, one for Paul and one for the panel. On what grounds did the Tenth Circuit reinforce Reynolds in the case, in the Potter case? And the second question for everyone, in what other kinds of cases has Reynolds been cited? You know, who has gotten shafted by this law besides the Mormons?
You know, I have not gone back and read that Tenth Circuit opinion for a long time, and so I can't quote you the exact language. It was not profound language. It was evasive language to get around this idea that the state really ought to have to prove the empirical superiority of monogamy. And so that's why, as I said, and what I remember is that it was a rehash of the rationale of Reynolds about the stability of society, the solidarity of the family, and that kind of stuff, but without the more hysterical things about, well, if we allowed this, we'd have to allow the settee and, a whole lot of other things. At this point, maybe somebody else has read that more recently and can really quote the language, but what has always stuck in my mind was it was a victory for us, but it was very weak and evasive language and avoided the issues rather than confronting them. And of course, the Supreme Court did not have to write an opinion. They just denied cert, so they didn't have to make any comment. And there was no evidence that there were any justices at the Supreme Court level who wanted to hear the Royston Potter case.
Let me see. I guess, no.
about marriage as the bedrock of society and so on. But, of course, the panel was bound. I mean, Reynolds is what we could still call good law, which doesn't mean it's a nice law. It just means it's binding. And the panel was bound by Reynolds.
The Tenth Circuit is not known for creating
Not inventive. And then the question about the application of Reynolds to other religious groups. I guess I said this last night to someone, I don't know whether it was after the session or while it was still ongoing. The basic rule in free exercise cases is that the plaintiff loses. It's a long, sad story. The victories are very few. They're very far between. They tend to be in the 60s and 70s, and to have been affirmed weekly thereafter, and not to have been extended. It would be really interesting to see the Yoder case that Paul mentioned, which involved Old Order Amish school children, and the question whether they had to go to school under state law, Wisconsin state law, until age 16, or whether their parents could pull them out at age 14, claiming that continued high school education undermined their ability, literally, to keep the kids down on the farm and in the faith. It would be interesting to see how that case went today. It certainly hangs out there by itself. So I guess the answer is Reynolds has been the rule rather than the exception in terms of outcome. In terms of being cited and being popular, it was very popular throughout the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. It began to be attacked in the 1950s, especially by legal scholars who said, this is really a fundamental denial of liberty, and this case should be revisited. And several prominent scholars predicted that the case would, in fact, be overruled. And Justice Douglas picked up on that in his partial dissent in this Yoder case, sort of saying, I'm worried that Reynolds will be overruled. And he was worried about it because he really thought Reynolds was rightly decided. He'd written the opinion in a case called, I want to say, Cleveland against the United States. Am I right? Yes, 1947, a Mann Act. Yeah, a Mann Act case, which involved the prosecution of a polygamous family for traveling across state lines. The Mann Act was designed to get at prostitution, and polygamists were analogized to pimps and prostitutes in this case. And he upheld the criminal conviction of Cleveland. So at any rate, my sense is Reynolds started out hugely popular, maintained an influence until 1950-55, was looked at by liberal scholars from various directions, and is now more vigorous in a more conservative climate than it was even 20 years ago. It's stronger now. I really agree with Paul. I think that's very perceptive.
And I would just reiterate the gut feeling that I have that what we're going to see in terms of dealing with the modern fundamentalism over the next few decades is just going to bring out the issues in terms of care. Probably in a somewhat different format, the exercise is going to be used as a test in general. That analysis is failing.
Just a quick historical note, the Peyote case that was just mentioned, you had these series of cases in the late 60s and early 70s saying things like, well, free exercise protects the Amish right to keep their kids down home on a farm. And what happened in the Peyote case, the Smith case in 1990, something rather our favorite Justice Scalia wrote the opinion, as I recall, and he took the case of like Yoder and went on and said, no, in fact, in all of those cases, the religious interest was coupled with some other sort of interest. In the Yoder case, it was coupled with a family interest. And so basically, Smith, as written by Scalia, says free exercise buys you nothing. In the only cases where it looks like it bought you something, that's because there was something else going for the plaintiffs.
I have a couple comments. Okay, without this Reynolds case, Do you think this would have affected our lives? I know I came from polygamous families. That means I probably would be a polygamist today. I mean, I think that it has changed the lives of some of the people in this room, you know. And the other thing I'd like to say is that the institutions at all levels, whether it's the family, the church, the country, you have to have certain rules and standards, you know, to inspire people to do better. I mean, you try to look out for the good. I don't know saying what they are, but, you know, I just, where do you draw the line?
Limited the number of Muslims, and I thought, oh, that's terrible for them, they're very liberal. And then I heard a speaker say, it's going to affect our attitude toward women. And I heard an editor in a Muslim country say that she did not favor the vote for women, and they said, but you're a radical, how can you say that? She said, the plural families are all conservative, and the conservatives will take over. Brigham Young was one of the first to give women the vote because of the fact that the women voted all exactly the way he said. I come from a Mormon background, and I left it. But one of the reasons was that things were given to women, including the beginning of the NRA. And this sort of blind acceptance of polygamy and not linking it to gay marriage, when the church is always claiming that the gays are committing pedophilia, and they're not, but many of the polygamists are. And this blind acceptance really, and I apologize, but I am beginning to be just a little bit irritated.
Oh boy. One of the things that has most fascinated me in my study of the entire Mormon question was how in the 19th century the debate was about, in many basic ways, the abuse of women, and that the justification for limiting the rights of local majorities was to protect vulnerable women. It gets a little awkward though when the women have the vote and say they don't want to be protected and look organized and well-dressed and so on, but then you just say, okay, they're victims of false consciousness, and what we really need to do is go in and clean up, and then they'll realize that they were being really badly abused. I mean, it's not so clean as anyone likes to portray it on either side, I think. What is fascinating about the 20th century's treatment of this is that it's recast into a question of civil libertarianism. And by that I mean a position that we, individuals, the state, anybody outside the immediate realm of the people who are individually involved, have no right, no legal right, probably no moral right, to criticize others for the choices they have made, as long as they are not physically harming other people. And that argument was very, and really held the ground for a good 30 or 40 years. It was really in the 90s that the issue of how women in polygamous societies were treated began to come to the forefront, especially with the Kingston prosecutions and so on. The issue of polygamy for women began to be debated. There's also, every couple of years, and people here, can you probably know it, Elizabeth Joseph writes a New York Times op-ed, you know, or I see it in one of the Salt Lake papers, and it's almost a post-feminist view, if I could put it this way, saying polygamy is great for women because she, I believe, and I'm going back several years to the, so correct me if I get her profession wrong, I think she's a lawyer. She's a lawyer. Yeah, and she said, you know what, I get great babysitting so I can go off and be a lawyer. And the argument is, women, the assumption is that women are responsible for the caretaking of the children that are born in a family. I have more women to help me out with that so that my freedom is greater. And that was a very strong argument made by women as well in the 19th century. So it's not as though there are feminist arguments made only on one side of the question. It is a hotly debated issue, and I think the way that it comes and goes is fascinating. It's a great question.
Just a couple of notes on other places to look for relevant information. I will preface it with a brief personal confession. I'm always ambivalent when I read this stuff, and I generally end up pissed off at everybody. I'm pissed off at Brigham Young and the kind of abuses that he put the people through. I'm pissed off at the federal authorities because I feel like they should be leaving us alone. They should be. And so, personally, I'm always ambivalent when I approach this. Following up on the comments about feminist arguments on both sides of the issue, I think at least some polygamists have made the argument that if polygamy weren't forced, if the entire practice of polygamy, including consenting adults, weren't forced underground, it might be easier to ferret out and prosecute abusive cases like the Kingstons, where you end up with pedophilia and things and incest and things along those lines. And I don't know where I come out on that issue, but there is at least an issue to be flagged. And then in terms of another excellent resource to look at, and going back to the original question, where would we be without Reynolds? There was an excellent piece in the Stanford Law Review a few years ago. I think probably everybody appears familiar with it. Who is the author? Thank you. The central argument of that entire article was the belief, what the subsequent history of Mormonism shows is the belief-action dichotomy in Reynolds doesn't hold water, because when you suppress the belief, when you suppress the action, the beliefs have to change to conform with the suppression of the conduct.
That's why it's called free exercise, yes. And then, yes.
Here and then. Do you want to come up and ask?
Come on.
I just find it interesting that some women thought that polygamy was so good for them because they could have free babysitting, but isn't it known that most of these women that, who lived in a lion house, for instance, they all had to take care of their own children, except for when somebody died and they left behind kids, and then in that case they would adopt their children. So really, how were the women benefiting from polygamy back then? I don't know. I don't see any benefits.
I'm not going to answer the question. I'm going to add to it. There's also a lot. If you read in the journals of a lot of Brigham Young's wives, you find out that he wasn't very good at taking care of their temporal needs either. They were left to care for not only for their families, but also for their physical welfare, bringing in money, bringing in food, things of that nature. So, try to make the question worse. Does anybody want to take it?
Well, I haven't stood up for many of these, but I feel like standing up for this because I probably have more contact with fundamentalist Mormons than any other members of this panel. I think the thing boils down to whether you're going to let people make their own decisions for the content of their own lives. If we ever get a world where you decide that we, meaning government or society, decides that there's some official entity that's going to make our personal decisions for us, and that the only valid decisions are the ones that you personally agree with, we are lost. Let people make their own decisions. They have a right to make bad decisions. We don't have the right to override the people's choices on the content, the structure of their families, and their personal lives. I believe that pretty strongly.
I hate to even get into this because it'll give Sally more impetus to go back for that PhD in sociology. But I think what this touches on is an area that is also still very understudied about polygamy. We know in general that there was a tremendous evolution of the polygamous family lifestyle from Nauvoo to early Salt Lake to later Salt Lake to Manifesto time, and then even into the post-manifesto period. And there were geographical differences, regional differences. Polygamy, the way it was practiced, even varied from town to town. Mormon scholars are just now getting into that. The most recent book that I'm aware of, and I have not read it yet, but I think it deserves being read in connection with Sally's book, is Catherine Dane's book, More Wives Than One, where she has used the town of Manti as a case study. We really know way too little in any empirical way about the dynamics of polygamous families over the years and over the decades that it was practiced and as it evolved. And we know mostly anecdotal kinds of reports, and we get the anecdotes from families where the memory is very negative and they tell us all the bad things that happened in it, and then we get anecdotes from another stream of families who have very positive things to report. And so it's another aspect of this that's very confusing. We probably have to leave that to the sociological historians.
If you have another question, we had someone in the back first, and then we'll work our way back up here.
Professor Gordon, and it's about something that you brought up in your talk, and I'd like to just elaborate on a little bit. And it's the ways in which different kinds of discourses and narratives about living in the 19th century connect, feed off of each other, in living as a broader subplot in foundational novel, as the way works like in One Young, Vulture Tour, Protestant arguments for preservation of kind of white American legal discourse. And they feed off each other, they feed each other, so they can see a little more about that. Oh, and the
yes, they do indeed. Thank you for that question. I am no literary critic by training, but I read anywhere between 85 and 95 anti-polygamy novels, and they different, you know, sometimes different editions are different enough to count them twice. So you know, that's why my numbers are a little fuzzy. What they tended to do was both to pick up on standard plot lines that you see across the board in pro-temperance fiction, anti-slavery fiction, anti-Catholic fiction, the sort of anti-fiction that you see across the 19th century, generally written for popular audiences, rarely read today. The one anti-polygamy novel that many people in this room might have read, even were they not interested in LDS history, is the first Sherlock Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet, one of the four longer novels. And that clearly picks up on several pieces of anti-polygamy fiction that were published as truth in magazines both in the U.S. and in England. What I found most fascinating, and these novels have generally been studied by historians of Mormonism, mostly to show both, you know, the kinds of really nasty things people were saying about Mormons and how badly they got things wrong. And both of those things are true. I guess what I was more interested in was what kinds of claims were these novelists making about the role of law in society? What kinds of laws protected individuals, especially women? They frequently were focused on, for example, a standard plot line would be a blooming New England maiden marries handsome yet dark New England man who has trouble working at the back of his eyes. Maybe too much ambition, a desire to rise above his place, maybe laziness, any number of of tragic flaws is contained within this man. He becomes entranced with the prophet and converts to Mormonism basically to accomplish whatever his nefarious goals are. That flaw comes to the surface, and poor blooming maiden is dragged out to Utah with this guy, who then betrays her by marrying again, and she dies either of some withering illness or a brain fever, and at her deathbed either one of her wives, one of her sister wives, or her husband converts to a life of anti-polygamy and escapes in dramatic fashion, dressed as an Indian or hidden in a... And frequently at the beginning and end of these novels and scattered throughout are poignant critiques of a legal system that doesn't protect women from abuse by husbands altogether. I mean, they are anti-domestic violence, and there's much hidden in there about condemnations of abuse, and those apply as well to monogamy. The argument is abuse is more likely in polygamy, but abuse is a bad thing altogether, and that travels like a big fat seam, a vein throughout these novels. They also talk about a system in which traveling further westward takes a person further away from the restraints of civilization, and those are couched not only in terms of class and religion, but also geography. And there's a sense of fear as each mile is passed, fear of what can happen out there. A sort of classic reversal of the adventure story. It's about what happens when adventure goes wrong. And so there's a sense in which there's a call, a very poignant call, for the imposition of regularized systems in these remote locations. Otherwise, people get lost and women suffer. That's the classic plot. They were very, very popular. One anti-Mormon novel I'm thinking of sold 10,000 copies just in its first year. It was published 2 years after Uncle Tom's Cabin, which created a very vigorous market for fiction, and in this sense, anti-polygamy fiction helped stoke that interest and fill the desire to read this stuff.
Kind of like anti-polygamy fiction of the Harry Potter of the 19th century. You sure? Okay. Robert? And this will be our last question.
I recently read Dwyer's Gentile Comes to Utah, which is a generation or two ago. It treats a lot of that, covers a lot of the same ground, kicks off the curtailment of Mormon rights, which is fairly well known to all of us. The thing that I found fascinating was it sounded, he didn't say it in these terms, but it sounded to me like in the effort to disestablish Mormonism in Utah, there was a certain amount of establishment, maybe not of Protestant religion, but certainly of Protestant value in Utah, because not only what went out the window with polygamy, not only polygamy left, but also the political kingdom and the economic kingdom. So there's that. And the one, and I wish I could remember the specific instances, but the one that I think I recall correctly was that it sounded like there was government funding for a group of women who had a house in Utah, and it was kind of like a halfway house for women. Yeah, for women that were coming, Mormon women coming out of polygamy. So my question is, after that long discussion, is, are you aware of other instances of what I'm going to call establishment of aspects of Protestantism within Utah territory?
Well, what comes to my mind is that, by the way, and I haven't thought of it in the context before, but, oh, okay, you have to know that you get it. Here's the point. The thing that comes to my mind is that when you find the theme, I think, if you read the date of the Utah Constitution,
many different drafts of constitutions. I would urge you to take a look before the 1890s. I guess I have suggestions, and you may well know these books, but Peggy Pascoe's Relations of Rescue is a very interesting book about moral reform undertaken by women's groups throughout the West. And some of her work, and I guess I would call it the progeny of her work, people who have studied Indian mission schools and so on, there's a pattern here. And then I guess on the demise of the economic system, I still think the Great Basin Kingdom makes a fantastic read. And the sense of loss that Arrington clearly felt at the possibility for alternative economic visions is poignant. And you're absolutely right that there's a sense in which more than one thing has been lost, perhaps to memory as well as to practice.
Thank you to the panelists, and thank you, Professor Gordon. It's been a wonderful session. Of course, Professor Gordon will be, I assume, happy to take a few more questions after we're done, if anyone's interested. Thank you very much.
Thank you.